If they're found guilty of murder, it is almost certain that they will receive the death penalty.
Testimony continues in the trial of Kim Jong-nam's alleged killers. It's Friday, October 6th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, China is selling more weapons. Cambodian politicians flee the country. A Japanese-born author wins a Nobel Prize. Community refrigerators and creating Wonder Woman. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The head of Malaysia's Center of Chemical Weapons Analysis has testified in a Kuala Lumpur courtroom that he found traces of the VX nerve agent on two women, one Vietnamese, the other Indonesian, who are on trial for the murder of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's half-brother. The testimony came 3 days after the women pleaded not guilty of smearing the nerve agent on the face of Kim Jong-nam, who had been living on the Chinese island of Macau at Kuala Lumpur International Airport February 13th in an apparent assassination. The women insist they were duped by North Korean agents into believing they would be participating in a hidden camera reality show. They testify they did not know who the victim was or that he had died until after they had been arrested. Their lawyers said their clients are scapegoats for the real killers, North Korean agents. James Chin is a Malaysia analyst at the University of Tasmania in Australia. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty just before the trial began that Malaysia barred its citizens from traveling to North Korea.
I think the Malaysian government was worried that if the trial goes badly for the North Koreans, they may hold Malaysian visitors in North Korea as hostages. The North Koreans have already done that once. So I think the Malaysians were just worried that they might do it again. So that's the reason why they banned all Malaysian citizens from traveling to North Korea.
Where is the body of Kim Jong-nam?
My understanding is that the body has already been released to the family and the body is no longer in Malaysia. All we know is that this trial is a highly politicized trial and the verdict can go either way.
Do we know how long this trial is going to last?
It will last approximately 5 to 6 weeks. So the actual hearing will be fairly quick, and after that, we'll probably get a fairly quick verdict as well.
What will be the fallout from that verdict?
It's very difficult to see how the trial will proceed properly because they don't have a motive and they don't actually have the paymaster. The people who paid these two women off are no longer in the country. Many people believe that the paymasters are all back in North Korea. So in terms of witnesses, they have a very limited range of witnesses. The only definite witnesses they have are the two women, plus the video recordings of what happened at the airport. Other than that, they don't really have much to go on.
North Korea has denied any involvement. Were any North Koreans allegedly involved?
According to the Malaysian authorities, the paymaster was actually a senior embassy official at the North Korean embassy in Kuala Lumpur. He has already left. In fact, he left on the very same day that the attack took place.
So these two women are the only suspects that are on trial and probably will be?
Yes. They don't have anybody else, unfortunately.
Does Malaysia have a death penalty?
Yes, Malaysia has a death penalty for a range of crimes, including murder.
If they go off to prison, is this case over, or will there be further prosecutions down the road?
I'm not sure. It depends very much on the results. If they are found guilty of murder, it is almost certain that they will receive the death penalty. But the problem, as I mentioned earlier, is that it's very difficult to do follow-ups given the fact that all the major players are outside Malaysia and all the major players are, in fact, in North Korea, and it's impossible to get any evidence or any information from the North Koreans.
At least 7 North Korean agents are believed connected to the attack. James Chin said the international consensus is that this was a political killing ordered by Kim Jong-un to eliminate a potential rival who reportedly has Chinese connections. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. Large numbers of opposition members of parliament fly out of Cambodia. New Japanese Conservative Party complicates election outlook. Australia to build photo database to identify terror suspects. Unrecognized at home, Rohingya refugee receives first ID card. Warming Arabian Sea triggers rise in extreme rainfall events in India. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also, stop by our VOAnews.com website. VOA Asia continues. China is gradually stepping up its military interaction with Southeast Asian nations after establishing some firm economic agreements with them. The latest move came Thursday when China gave 3,000 assault rifles to the Philippines as a gesture of what was called friendly and cooperative relations. It was the second shipment of guns to Manila. The rifles, valued at about $3.3 million, will all go to the Philippine National Police, which U.S. legislators said last year they blocked from buying about 26,000 M4 rifles from the United States. Other countries, including Thailand, Malaysia, Myanmar, are also forging stronger military ties with China. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about this with Timothy Heath. He's senior international defense researcher at the RAND Corporation. Timothy has worked for more than 16 years on the tactical, operational, and strategic levels in the U.S. military, focusing on Asia.
I think China's goals in selling these arms to the Philippines are at least threefold. First, China is trying to increase its influence in the countries of Southeast Asia. Second, it is selling arms in the hopes that governments in Southeast Asia can suppress and control internal threats that could impact Chinese investment projects in those countries. And then third, I think China is looking for export markets for its own defense industries.
Well, when you look toward this latest sale to the Philippines, especially when you add on other sales to some controversial areas, especially in Myanmar, it seems as though Beijing is looking to fill some holes in territory and customers, if you will, that the United States had, correct?
I agree that China senses an opportunity. China is watching the U.S. appear to reduce its interest and engagement in Asia, and China is looking to take advantage of what they see as an opportunity.
What does this mean to the United States as far as diplomacy, as far as the overall world outlook is concerned? What's the overall view here?
Well, I think Washington should be alarmed. There is a sign going on that should be bright and clear to the United States that Asia is open for business with China and could be encouraged to tilt more towards China if the United States does not remain engaged and if it does not work very closely with its allies and partners in the region.
Well, if you are to label this any kind of a withdrawal of any kind by the United States, is this limited to the current administration or has this been happening before the Trump administration took office?
Well, I think it's premature to say the U.S. is withdrawing. There does seem to be, under the current government, a turning inward towards domestic issues. I do think some of that was starting to happen under the Obama administration. As we saw, the TPP was already running into trouble. However, the fundamental reality is America's economic future is deeply tied to Asia, and it is going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for this government and future administrations to really withdraw from Asia. We are going to be in Asia. We have no choice about it. The question is, how do we engage more effectively?
What is an Asian world in China's view? What would Beijing like it to be?
I think what Beijing would like to see for Asia is an international security order in which countries defer to Beijing on controversial issues that touch on anything that Beijing regards as sensitive. Beijing would like, in short, a veto vote on security issues in Asia, and it is looking to build that leverage over its neighbors through trade, through arms sales, through diplomatic engagement, and will continue to do so.
What about countries that are still seen as very strong allies with the United States?
Thailand and the Philippines are becoming important destinations for Chinese arms exports. Traditionally, these are strong allies of the United States, and the fact that they are buying more Chinese weapons shows that China is determined to cultivate influence in those countries. It is looking to wean those countries off of their dependence on the United States as a security ally and to instead transfer their political relationship more towards China.
Has the United States made any effort of which you are aware to address this with China?
It is a little bit difficult to discern the clear Asia strategy in the current administration. I don't want to say a whole lot about what is going on between the various parts of the administration since I'm not totally clear myself, but I'm hoping that our government can articulate a clearer strategy for strengthening its influence, strengthening America's relationship in Asia, and making sure that our allies' security needs are met in a way that is takes into account American interests as well.
Timothy Heath is Senior International and Defense Researcher at the RAND Corporation. Tim, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Happening now in Asia, officials in Bangladesh say the world's largest refugee camp is being built to house over 500,000 Rohingya who have fled to Myanmar. Refugees who are currently scattered in 23 camps along the border will be transferred to one central camp in Cox's Bazar. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're very happy you're with us today on VOA Asia. Almost half of Cambodia's opposition lawmakers have left the country or are in jail, including most of its leadership, as proceedings to dissolve the party move forward. It was no longer possible to save democracy from inside Cambodia, said Cambodia National Rescue Party leader Mu Socha, who fled on Tuesday, saying she had been tipped off her arrest was imminent. Socha said it was better to advocate outside the country than be jailed under a co-opted legal system. She has called for targeted international sanctions on ruling party leaders. A complaint requesting the dissolution of her party was filed by the Cambodian Youth Party, citing the widely decried treason charge of CNRP leader Kem Sokha, who was arrested in September. On Monday, Prime Minister Hun Sen warned the treason case against Sokha would be extended, potentially resulting in the arrest of other opposition lawmakers. CNRP Chief Whip Son Chahe, who is one of the last remaining party leaders in the country, told VOA last week prior to Sochua's departure that 22 opposition lawmakers had flown to different countries to brief their overseas constituents on the present crisis.
I think it had been beyond the we call it red line. But as you know, the alternative for the future of Cambodia must lay in the election.
At the time, he said he was confident many of the lawmakers overseas would come back in October. Sebastian Strangio, author of Hun Sen's Cambodia, said trying to ramp up international pressure against Hun Sen from abroad was unlikely to prove an effective strategy for CNRP leaders, while the prime minister enjoyed very strong support from China. Our thanks to David Boyle, who contributed reporting to this story. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the emergence of a new conservative-leaning Japanese political party is presenting an unexpected challenge to Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition in the snap election he recently scheduled to extend his hold on power. If Abe's party maintains its majority October 22nd, Abe could remain prime minister until 2021. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, British author Kazuo Ishiguro has been awarded the 2017 Nobel Prize in Literature. The 62-year-old author was born in Nagasaki, Japan. He moved to Britain when he was 5 years old. VOA's Sarah Williams speaks with Philip Langeskov, a lecturer in creative writing at the University of East Anglia, where Ishiguro studied and where the author will appear at a symposium next week.
One of the things that makes him unique, I think, is that his work is enormously varied. He's a restless writer who doesn't sort of rest on the successes of his previous books or try to imitate their style. He looks to change genre, to change style, to change approach on a book-by-book basis. So his works move from dealing with notions of a historical past in books like A Pale View of the Hills or The Remains of the Day to speculative fictions like Never Let Me Go, and then most recently he's moved into fantasy with The Buried Giant. So it's hard to pin down what is unique about his work, but what I would say a characteristic of his writing throughout his career is this really genuinely remarkable sense of control of tone and measure, the way that language unfolds both on the page and in the ear. And alongside that, there's this preoccupation with the operation of memory, what we remember, how that remembering might transform or shape us. Those are two significant aspects of his work, but perhaps most significant for me as a reader and as an admirer of his work is the way that he captures the sense of the double lives that all of us live. There's the life that we live on the streets, you might say, you know, the life of everyday reality, of observable fact and physical appearances, but at the same time, we're each of us living the life of the mind, which is made up of dreams and imagination, half-thoughts and speculations. And those two different ways of living are quite different, but they happen at exactly the same time. They coexist in our experience of the world. And I think he captures that in a way quite unlike any other writer that I can think of.
He's had a very interesting life, and he was born in Japan, and I believe he lived there as a small child, but then moved with his parents to the UK. What are kind of the influences of both countries on his writing?
We do know that he was born in Nagasaki in 1954, that he moved to England at the age of five, and he didn't return to Japan until 1989. Nonetheless, I think it is possible to see an identification between certain Japanese social and cultural inheritances and certain British ones. I sort of advance these theories slightly hesitantly. But you might say that both those societies underwent in the years following World War II a move from being sort of quite buttoned up societies bound by certain social conventions and codes of behavior to being much more open and fluid societies. And a lot of his work deals with the sort of fallout from that change in social behavior.
Lecturer Philip Langeskov speaking about Nobel Literature winner Kazuo Ishiguro with VOA's Sarah Williams. This news alert from VOA Asia, U.S. lawmakers are calling for full access by journalists and aid workers to Myanmar's troubled Rakhine state. The Trump administration has promised $32 million in assistance, $28 million of which would go to Bangladesh, where roughly a half million Rohingya have fled from across the border since August. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, globally around the world, of all the food produced for human consumption is wasted or lost before it can reach consumers. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization says that even if just one-fourth of that food could be saved, it would be enough to feed 870 million hungry people. One initiative to combat food waste and reach the hungry has been catching on in many cities across the world, community refrigerators, as VOA's Faiza El-Masri tells us in this report narrated by Faith Lapidus.
The idea is simple. Instead of throwing away unused, still good-to-eat food, local businesses and residents can leave it in a public refrigerator for others. This new fridge is situated in the heart of London's Brixton district. Neighboring business owners help stock and clean the fridge each day. According to the People's Fridge founders, food waste is a huge issue in Britain. On average, restaurants throw away 900,000 tons of food each year, while households waste the equivalent of 24 edible meals a month. But with 8.4 million people in Britain living in food insecurity, that food could be going to good use and the People's Fridge helps bridge that gap. Employees at the Ritzy Cinema are now giving their cafe's surplus cakes to the fridge instead of sending them to a landfill.
We heard about it. A staff member had come down and heard about the project, and it just seemed like a great idea. Businesses like ours, we waste a lot of food off, and to then donate it to people who are in need and to help support the community in Brixton, which we're a big part of, is kind of important to us.
A group of 25 food activists came up with the idea of starting the People's Fridge and raised more than $2,500 to start the project.
Food we've put on the shelves, or we've had put on the shelves, is generally leaving the shelves within 36 hours of it being there. There are lots of people who are in work, who are receiving an income, but who still can't afford the rising costs of food and who really benefit from such initiatives. Here, from my experience, it certainly feels like there is demand, and the demand is rising.
Anyone can donate food or take it out. The People's Fridge provides a visible focus for cutting food waste and feeding the hungry in London. Founders hope they'll inspire other cities around the world. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
A new film starring Luke Evans, Rebecca Hall, and Bella Heathcote, Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman, tells the biographical story of the man who came up with the Wonder Woman comic. As VOA Asia's David Byrd tells us, the film doesn't shy away from the character's real-life turmoil and adventure.
William Moulton Marston was a Harvard professor who was in love with two women, his wife Elizabeth and Olive Byrne, one of his students who became his assistant and later his lover. Out of their polyamorous relationship comes the Wonder Woman comic book.
She's an Amazon princess that lives on an island of all women.
Paradise Island.
And all her friends and helpers are sorority girls who have spanking parties and everybody fights Nazis and rides in an invisible plane.
Yes.
Bill, we love you truly so much. But nobody, and I say this with all the compassion and truth in my heart, nobody will ever publish this.
At the film's premiere at the Toronto Film Festival, Luke Evans said that he was most impressed that the script was based on a true story.
I mean, that's the most shocking bit, is that this story is true, that this man was a Harvard professor of psychology in the 20s, went on to invent the lie detector test, or the early forms of the polygraph, what became the polygraph, then fell in love with not just his wife, but another woman who then shared their lives for the rest of his life, had a wonderful family, and then created Wonder Woman.
Australian actress Bella Heathcote, who plays Olive Byrne, says that she feels really lucky to be part of a film that tells Wonder Woman's origin story.
I mean, it's great to tell the origin story about this character who's a feminist icon, created by feminists, based on these two women who he loved. And the message is all about empowerment and equality.
Angela Robinson, who directed several television series, including True Blood, Charlie's Angels, The L Word, and How to Get Away with Murder, directed the film. In Toronto, Robinson said her film sends a feminist message through its portrayal of women who are not afraid to follow their own desires.
My film is about, there's this really amazing love story at the center of what Wonder Woman eventually came to be. So it was really excited to kind of bring that to the screen and see where Wonder Woman kind of truly began.
William Marston died of skin cancer in 1947, but Elizabeth and Olive stayed together and reared their and Marston's children together. Professor Marston and the Wonder Women is rated R for strong sexual content, including brief graphic images and language. It opens in U.S. theaters October 13th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. We say hello to everybody listening in Myanmar via Facebook on VOA Burmese. Thank you for stopping by today. You can also catch us on our Facebook page, VOA Asia, and we stream on the VOA.com website. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Carl Starling, managing editor, Diane Gao, Ali Ogden, David Byrd, Ira Melman on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We hope you have a great day.